When you invest in ETFs, your capital is at risk. This show is for professional investors only.
So hello everyone and welcome to the latest episode of Thematic Matters. I'm Jake Coulson, investment writer at Han ETF, and today we'll be taking a deep dive into the space economy theme. Space has long been viewed as humanity's final frontier. In 1961, Yuri Gagarin became the first human to reach outer space, and by 1969, NASA had landed three astronauts on the moon. But since then, mankind's giant leap into space has surpassed curious exploration. We now rely on in-space technology to enhance and maintain our everyday lives on Earth. A space economy is therefore developed, comprising thousands of orbital satellites, cutting-edge hardware, and longer-term themes, such as space tourism. The Pure Space UCITS ETF was Europe's first pure-play space ETF and aims to capture the nascent space economy. It tracks the S-Network Space Index. And to cover the space theme in more detail, we're today joined by Andrew Channing, the co-founder and CEO of Pure. Pure manages the US-listed version of the space ETF, which has accrued over $46 million in assets under management. So without further ado, welcome, Andrew.
Thanks for having me. Thrilled to be here.
Brilliant to have you here. So I thought we'd just start off, Andrew, by just briefly letting us know who Procure are.
Wonderful. So Procure is a company that was started by Robert Tull and myself, along with a few others, bringing our first US-listed product to market back in 2019. And our backgrounds span the ETF world. I got my start in exchange-traded funds, working at on the floor of the American Stock Exchange for the largest ETF specialist trading firm at the time, Kellogg Group, back in 2007, where my partner, Robert Tull, actually was working on the first products that actually ended up becoming, via acquisition, iShares. And so, our experience in the markets go back very far. Bob, with an incredible amount of experience in the operational side of the exchange-traded product world. My backgrounds with ETFs include being a trader, market maker, prop trader, as well as now issuer and sponsor, marketer, sales for exchange-traded funds. So we wear a lot of different hats and have a really well-rounded background in the exchange-traded product marketplace. And we look to bring all different types of new thematic angles for individuals and institutions alike to get exposure to around the world.
And space is certainly a pretty new thematic angle. I wonder what drew you to space in the first place? What was it that made you want to pick this sector in particular?
Yeah, I think the same things that we see and saw are the same things that many people look at and understand when they think about the space industry. When looking at the thematic world, in many ways, it is important to be first to market. And being able to provide the theme of space to individuals that are looking to get that exposure around the world is something that I think certainly fascinated us from not just being first to market, but looking at an industry that we believed was truly in its infancy, despite having been around, like you mentioned, since the 60s at the latest, for an industry that's been around for so long, this is still very early days. And the reason that this industry is starting to see an inflection point is because of many new companies, technologies, government programs that are really propelling and driving this industry forward. Most notably, the advent of reusable rockets, which has not only sped up the time that companies can send things to space, but has also significantly reduced the cost of launch. And the opportunities that opens for space industry players, as well as for those looking to expand their business capabilities into allowing what space can offer for them, for their clients, for consumers, is truly an interesting time period for this industry. So, experience in ETFs, fascination with space, and interest in all the incredible things that the space industry is doing, not just for the space industry itself, but for many other industries around the globe, is what made space so important for us and made space so important now.
And one of those sort of elements of the space industry, if you like, is obviously satellites, right? It's something that we use in our everyday lives, whether it's from Google Maps or anything of that caliber, right? But we've seen recently a new importance, right, which is their importance to global conflicts. So something we saw recently when Russia invaded Ukraine, there was a hack on the Viasat satellite, something that was quite interesting. And since then, a lot of the Ukrainian soldiers had to rely on the SpaceX Starlink constellation. So I wonder if you could explain the role of satellites overall in the theme, but then also the changing role of satellites, how we might begin to see them in conflicts on Earth and potentially even conflicts in space.
Absolutely. So, satellites. When someone thinks of the idea of a satellite, they picture some, likely large structure that's, orbiting around its base at incredibly fast speeds. Yeah. Now, what that satellite might do to, many different people is, a completely different type of application. And, some people see satellites as these connectors for communications. Others think of satellites as, what's used by the military or spy satellites or satellite imagery. There's many different use cases for satellites. And unlike the early days where a satellite would serve one singular function and then eventually be decommissioned at its end of life, now we're seeing satellites with tremendous amount of capabilities, including reprogrammable capabilities to potentially change the purpose or the function or the goal of a satellite, or potentially have multiple functions for an individual satellite. Additionally, these satellites might be extremely small, something known as a CubeSat, something that is incredibly small, lightweight, works with other different CubeSats potentially, part of a constellation. But satellites do so much for us at a government level, at a corporate level, at an individual level. And satellites may be used, like you mentioned, to do surveillance and imagery. And what we noticed at the start of the Ukrainian-Russian conflict was a company called Maxar, a former Index component, was sending imagery of buildup of troops and supplies at the border of Ukraine and Russia. And this was an early indicator that a conflict was brewing. And not only was that kind of the first use of satellites during this Ukrainian-Russian conflict, but Russia actually took hostage of numerous OneWeb satellites, which are technically part property to the UK government. These satellites were a pawn in a negotiation tactic where they were sitting at the launch pad in the Baikonur, Kazakhstan launch pad, which Russia uses frequently for its own space capabilities, and these satellites were being held hostage. So we've seen satellites not even in orbit being used as a political tool. And that had made many governments, militaries, companies around the world start to question allies and trade partners and suppliers and service providers for space. So it's going to be very unlikely that you'll see a US and likely a UK company in the future say, we are going to align with Russian space launch capabilities because that is no longer viewed as a reliable trade partner for space for many different countries after this incident. Additionally, you mentioned Viasat. And early on in the conflicts, there were satellites that were being jammed and made inoperable so that entities that were trying to utilize satellites, whether for military, government, or even individual use, were not able to have this steady, uninterrupted stream for communications purposes. So it brought to light the importance of redundancy and having other types of communication capabilities. Also, at the early start of this conflict, we saw tons of news reports coming out that top military and political personnel within Ukraine were starting to be issued satellite phones so that they could have uninterrupted and secure communications that were at, you know, high levels of intelligence communities. So you know, that was another area of importance during this conflict. And then you saw a company like SpaceX come in, offering satellite communication capabilities via its property Starlink. And so this is just at the very early stages of the Ukrainian-Russian conflict, seeing how important space has become from a government, military, and intelligence perspective. So you know, that is one way you have satellites are used for surveillance, but also the safe, secure, uninterrupted communications. And when you look at the size of the space industry today, roughly one third of the size of the overall space economy is represented by satellites and communications. So, like we said, these satellites could offer many different types of capabilities, uses, functionality. But one of the beauties is that the cost of sending satellites to space has come down so much that it's creating all new opportunities for users and suppliers of satellite capabilities and technologies.
It's a super interesting point, and this idea of satellites becoming so sort of quintessential to global conflicts. I wonder, obviously, this we have seen that satellites have been targeted, whether it be by hacks. Do you think that there is more that satellite makers will have to think about in terms of protecting their own satellites? I mean, was there a reason that the Starlink constellation wasn't targeted, unlike, you know, Viasat, like we said before? You know, what do you think satellite manufacturers will be thinking about when future-proofing their satellites from those kind of attacks?
Well, you know, SpaceX and Starlink, you know, they do believe that they're potentially susceptible to attacks, whether it be Russia, China, or other entities. So this has been something that they publicly announced is a concern, to the extent that certain satellites are taken out or made inoperable. With Starlink and other competitors look to have different capabilities via redundancy. So not having to rely on just one, two, three satellites, but when we're talking about these constellations that are going up, we're talking about potentially tens of thousands of satellites being launched into low Earth orbit that could help with redundancy. That also creates new potential problems, which is if space is too crowded, there's an increased risk of collision, whether that be with other spacecraft or potentially debris from previous space activities, and that can the creation of a whole new industry for debris mitigation, debris removal, debris recycling, tracking where the debris is so that you can have proper technology so your satellites can move out of harm's way. There are a lot of things to be considered, but cybersecurity and having hardware that's intelligently developed to try to help prevent cyber attacking. But we've also seen countries display their ability to take out satellites in space via missiles. There's also the use of laser technology to potentially harm or alter satellite usability. So, there's all different types of threats, beyond just, cyber threats. There are, the threats of physical, damage as well. And even things that aren't necessarily nefarious, but space debris is another potential threat to these satellite assets in space today. And each of these require attention, require redundancy and capabilities. And there are many potential companies or industries within space that could benefit from both the opportunities and these risks.
I guess on the less sort of conflict side as well, we spoke earlier about satellites being used for imagery, for example, whether that's used for mapping and things like that. But one of the interesting things I was reading recently was that satellites being used to tell us more things about the world we live on in terms of things like climate change, right? To sort of screen for how far that's progressed and look at the areas that are affected worse.
Absolutely. And, space has been targeted by some activists as being a dirty industry, that sending up spacecraft creates emissions. The reality is, though, so much of what we're doing for space is actually helping us here on Earth. And one great quote that I had heard from from a colleague in the industry was that although space gets a bad rap for emissions and potentially climate change, we wouldn't even understand climate change if it wasn't because of the space industry and satellites that are actually constantly observing, taking pictures, sending video, providing tremendous amounts of data for us back here on Earth are actually helping us better understand climate change. There's a satellite company out of Canada that specifically is focused on emissions that occur on Earth. Methane emissions is believed by many to be a cause of and contributor to climate change. And being able to detect these emissions from space is just one of the many ways that we utilize satellites to help us here on Earth. Weather changes. Well, when you're looking for hurricanes and water-related natural disasters, space is really helpful. So we're able to detect and track these storms, understand their patterns better, hopefully give us better preparation to understand the timing that you have to prepare, as well as more accurate models to help us predict where these paths of these storms will be moving. Looking at sea level rises and changes, looking at deforestation in areas like the Amazon and other areas, helping us track the wildfires in Canada, which became major headlines in North American news. These are all really important problems that we're trying to tackle, and space is helping us to better understand the world that we live in. And so space has actually become one of the most important assets that we have in helping us both understand and tackle climate change.
I think that idea of space being used to tackle climate change is quite, it's exemplified by something I read in your recent monthly report, which was about the use of solar and potentially, essentially using renewable energy in space. Is that something you could talk to us a little bit about?
So, for decades, the idea of capturing energy in space and sending it down to Earth for use has been around. And in recent years, countries, universities, even military apparatuses have understood the importance and the value of being able to harness the sun's power, but by trying to create a method that is continuous. So one problem with solar energy, which people are familiar here today, it's a large generator of power, an important power source for many use cases here on Earth. One problem with it is that when the sun goes down or when the weather is bad and the clouds are out, you could have interrupted service. And with energy, when you need it, you need it. And so, yes, we've made advances with batteries and being able to store this power. But if you could have a continuous, uninterrupted source of energy, imagine the amount of use cases that you could have. You could not just power singular homes, but potentially entire communities and industries. And the concept stems from having these arrays out in space that would capture the sun's energy and convert it into microwave energy, which would then be beamed down to ground stations here on Earth that would collect this microwave energy and be able to convert it into electrical usage for us here on Earth. So, you hear about EVs and how electric vehicles are going to change the world, but still they need to get their power source to power those batteries in the cars from somewhere. And in many cases, it's still coal or other fossil fuel generated power sources. But if you could have continuous sources powering grids, this could be a complete game changer. So being able to figure out a way of doing this safely and at scale could be an incredible way of creating clean, renewable energy at a fraction of the cost of many other sources that are currently out there. So, it's something where space has already driven the technology of solar power further than it would have been without space's collaboration, because solar has been used as a power source for satellites and other spacecraft for a long time now. And that technology has been enhanced, improved by space companies for that need. And this is a very large opportunity. Now, is it going to happen in the next decade? Very likely that we wouldn't see this potentially for several decades to come. However, we are starting to see countries like Japan, the US, countries around Europe understand that this is a very realistic, attainable type of technology. And we're starting to see the early progress for this already, with Japan looking to do several experiments where they will look to be collecting and potentially sending a beam of energy back down to Earth within the next few years.
Well, moving away from the infrastructure side, something that's a little bit less far off is space tourism, which is sort of an interesting buzzword. This, lots of different corporations are attempting this. And there's lots of talk around it. I wondered if you could just talk about this whole phenomenon. How's the sector developing? What do you expect to see from it in the coming decade? And how sort of likely is it that space tourism will become, not necessarily an everyday thing, but quite a normalized thing?
So space tourism is here. We're living in the era of space tourism. And we've seen numerous successful flights already occur within the last 2 years. Most recently, Virgin Galactic has received the green light to open its window to send paying commercial space tourists on the trip of a lifetime. And we're still in very early days. And this is currently today a very small industry. And there's different analysts out there that predict that on a bullish case, that by the end of this decade, that space tourism may represent $3 to $4 billion annually in revenues. And so even if analysts are correct, this would still be a very small percent of the overall space economy in the near future. Roughly less than 1% of today's current space economy, today, looking at by the end of these decades, 3 to 4 billion numbers. So, this isn't necessarily a major driver for space, but it is opening new opportunities. And what will be really interesting to see is, what is the addressable market for this? How many people, even if they can afford the several hundred thousand to potentially millions of dollar ticket to go to space, how many people are actually interested in doing so? Is it a factor of driving the cost down? And that's just certainly a goal of some of these companies, to be able to provide a more affordable way of sending people to space. Because at the current price tags, it's pretty difficult for many people to be able to go on one of these journeys. But we're also starting to see more potential differentiation in opportunities. And so the early stage of space tourism looks to be sending people for a very short trip, maybe a matter of minutes into space, whether that's suborbital or orbital. We noticed that SpaceX potentially has an offering, if they'd like to put it out there, where people can go on an orbital trip. So traveling several times around the planet on potentially more than several minutes, potentially several days long journey, which likely would be more expensive than the several minute options that are a little bit more readily available today. But beyond these quick trips in a spacecraft or above Earth or around Earth and then back home, the idea of space hotels is becoming more realistic as well. So not just would highly trained astronauts potentially have the ability to look at Earth back from a space station, but future space stations could also be lodging solutions. And whether those lodging solutions would have their own wholly owned proprietary spacecraft that would send you from Earth to the space station and back, or whether they would have to utilize third-party capabilities, these are all areas that are not so distant into the future. And Airbus is looking at its own modular style of space station to replace the aging International Space Station, and you know, potentially their solution could be used for numerous different purposes, such as hospitality, but also research and training and education that is very important for how we currently use space stations today. So what we're looking at is how we're currently building out this infrastructure, and potentially to the extent that we can drive costs down significantly further, can open up many opportunities for space tourism and beyond.
Fantastic. And I think that sort of brings me on to one of my final questions, which is, what to you is the biggest driver in this space? And excuse the uptown words there, but you know, if you're an investor looking to get into this sector, what do you think is the biggest driving factor?
Yeah, I think technologies have truly come a long way. And in the early days of the space race, it was almost entirely funded by governments, government agencies, and militaries. And as time has progressed, we've seen that commercial space has become the big driver. And you know, roughly 80-ish percent of the space economy is commercial. That said, militaries and governments around the world have learned and understood that space is the new strategic high ground for military conflict. And that is why we're seeing so much spending out of Europe, so much spending out of the US, out of Russia, out of China, out of India, and beyond to become space superpowers. Because you can either take one of three approaches. You can become a leader on your own and build out your own capabilities. You can find allies that can hopefully help you achieve your various goals, at the risk, though, of becoming reliant upon these allies. Or your third option is just staying out of this entirely. And you know, that option is not really viewed by the largest nations on Earth as a viable path forward. And as these countries understand from events that we've seen recently unfold in Russia and Ukraine, it's really important to have your own capabilities. And this potential ramp up in spending towards space, could potentially be something that we see for a long time, as the new space race is not just one of vanity and saying, hey, we did this first, but ones with real life applications, use cases, and with national defense and national security at one of the highest areas of importance. So, although it's been great to see the commercial side of space become such a driver, it does not seem too off the map that governments, government agencies, and militaries could become another large driver for this industry going forward, and particularly in one area that could have military defense as well as commercial benefits, is an area that we're seeing in hypersonics, and where we're learning that Russia and China have leapfrog capabilities of the West. This is an area where we're seeing significant spending, and this could help from a safety and security standpoint. But to the extent that we can be sending point-to-point hypersonic transportation here on Earth, the ability to send passengers looking to go somewhere, or extremely vital resources or assets to any point on the globe within a couple of minutes to a couple hours, depending on the location, is something that could be a really big driver for the space economy in the future.
Great. And just to finish off, I had one more thing that I wanted to talk to you about, actually. And I know from some of your writings that you like to delve into conceptual ideas around space, such as maybe areas of the space economy that are so far science fiction, but could become reality sooner than we might think. Like, for example, earlier we were talking about space debris collection. That's, as far as I know, is not an industry that exists yet. But do you think there are other industries like this that will appear sooner than we think, and that it will develop the theme sort of accordingly?
So not that I'm going to make projections or predictions, but I think one thing that seems like people don't understand how close we are to being there is the colonization of the moon. And I'm not talking about a million people living on the moon, but by the end of this decade, there are numerous countries that look to have built out some type of permanent presence on the moon. And, this creates a whole bunch of potential conflict, but, also opportunity. And you know, there are numerous companies that are publicly traded these days that are even focused on the moon or what's known as the cislunar economy. And you know, although it seems like science fiction to many, and people think of Elon Musk's conversations about building out colonies on Mars, governments and research groups are looking to start to build out these permanent bases on the moon. So, resources become important, infrastructure becomes important, communications becomes important. And to the extent that nations are vying against nations to have these stronger permanent presences on the moon, this could lead to, another space race within the space race. So whether that's building out research bases, which is currently allowed under various treaties and agreements, to potentially building out military capabilities, which is something that I think many people are opposed to seeing. But regardless to how people feel, sometimes things progress forward. And it's going to be really important that we have agreed upon guidelines and rules for how various countries can utilize the moon. But the end of the century is coming a lot quicker than a lot of people seem to realize. And having a dominant position on the moon is a goal of many nations out there. And so keep your eye on that, and don't be surprised to learn of plenty of companies that are building out even singular focuses with the moon as their goal.
Well, Andrew, thank you very much. I mean, this has been an absolute pleasure. I'm somebody who loves hearing about space, and this is such an exciting theme that, as you've literally just said, could change so dramatically over the coming decades in ways that we probably don't even expect. So thank you so much for joining us today. It was great to have you on. And for those of you who are listening, if you want to find out a bit more about the space theme, head over to hannitf.com. And for now, that's goodbye from myself and goodbye from Andrew.